A disgraced former Prime Minister broadcasting on YouTube from a cupboard. A Green Party leader podcasting what critics call nauseatingly cosy left-wing populism. A Taoiseach in waiting doing soup recipes on TikTok. And a presidential candidate quietly eating the under 35 vote by hopping between Blind Boy, Louise McSharry and How to Gael. Politicians aren't just running for office anymore. They're running their own digital media empires. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Sean Defoe. Podcasts, TikTok, Substack, YouTube, the whole political ecosystem is tilting towards more long-form, first-person digital communication to talk to people. Some politicians are really good at it. Some are brilliant. And some, well, they're just catastrophically bad. And a few, like Liz Truss, well, they're so strange they may end up defining the genre by accident. So today we're asking, why are so many politicians bypassing traditional media? Why do some thrive online while others flounder? And would the Irish public actually buy into a full-blown politician-run podcast culture? And to help me make sense of this increasingly weird frontier, I'm joined by writer and broadcaster and friend of the podcast, Paddy Duffy. Paddy, good to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you, Sean.
So, listen, I mentioned it there, Liz Truss, that is the jumping off point. And I think before we get into it ourselves, we're just going to have to hear a little bit of this.
We'll be talking to the leading lights of the MAGA movement. We'll be dissecting Project 2025. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the home of the counter-revolution. Welcome to the Liz Truss Show.
Paddy, I think your first book was called Did That Actually Happen? After watching Liz Truss's foray onto YouTube, were you asking, did that actually happen?
Yeah, I definitely need to get a reprint of that bad boy out after everything that's happened sort of recently. You know, the funny thing I find about Liz Truss is that she's the most free market politician out there. Like, that is really where she makes her bread and butter. And yet the irony is that nobody wants this. Nobody has asked for this. It's just, it sort of dropped out of nowhere. It's like, you know, they tried to silence me. They failed. That's how she trailed it. So everyone was kind of going, is it really? I thought you were just kind of maybe keeping it quiet because, you know, you barely lasted 50 days in office. But no, as it turns out, she's been silenced. The whole thing was just absolutely bizarre from the outset, like Sean. I mean, first of all, I think the thing about it is that as you've heard there, there's a couple of things to pick up from that, I think. It's A, she is completely devoid of charisma in every way, shape and form. Total charisma vacuum.
And also can't read a script. I would also just put that out there as someone who read a script at the top of this podcast. There's a certain knack to it. She does not have that knack.
No, absolutely. No, you can tell that she's reading Lacey. Yeah, you're kind of imagining the teleprompter rather than actually watching her, which is never a great sign. But also what is interesting about it is that she's talking about, just even in that clip there, it was very indicative, I think, of the whole thing, which is the fact that she talks about MAGA and she talks about Project 2025 and she talks about counter-revolution. Now, this all sounds incredibly American to me, both in terms of, you know, sort of the actual literal aspects of it, but then also stuff like counter-revolution is incredibly sort of hyperbolic and American. So it seems to me that, you know, it used to be a case that sort of an ex-prime minister would, you know, maybe form their own institute and go sort of, you know, globetrotting and try to be some sort of elder instead of in the world stage, whereas she is going straight for the American YouTube audience, which is a real sign of the times, I suppose.
Yeah, no, completely. What struck me from listening to it, and my ears were sort of bleeding on the dart on the way in as I listened to the episode with her and Steve Bannon, which is quite something. I'm not sure I would encourage people to listen to it, but if people want a bit of an eye-opener to what this is like, is that she believes, and seems to very genuinely believe, she did nothing wrong, and that everybody else, the entire world, the entire UK economy that almost collapsed because of her, whatever you call it, mini-budget that wasn't a mini-budget, everyone else was wrong, but me.
Yeah, it feels convenient, I suppose, whenever you kind of bring yourself into a sort of an ideological cul-de-sac like she has, because what's great about that is that it doesn't matter what you've been stymied at every turn. It's like, oh, if I'd only been given a bit of extra time, if I'd only actually been able to cut harder and wider and deeper, then actually we would have been out of it. But you know, but the cruel deep state deprived me and you, the British public, of this great thing. And so it's this is one of the great things, I suppose, about that narrative, is that you can prove yourself right at absolutely every turn. The problem is, though, and she sort of serves as a rather kind of uncanny example of this, is that you need to be able to sell that adequately. And Liz Truss has never been adequately able to sell anything in her life. And that's where she is in this cupboard.
It's also funny because she's talking about, oh, if I'd only be given the chance to lead this financial revolution, the counter-revolution that you're talking about, and then somewhat ignores the fact that she sacked the finance minister that she appointed to lead that revolution after it went wrong after 38 days.
Well, and this is it, because it's, you know, she ended up essentially panicking in office. I mean, it's funny to think, because like this all happened in the space of about just over a month, and it just from day to day it was just one sort of one catastrophe to another. I mean, it's one of those things. It's like, I suppose the thing about being a prime minister is that you would kind of hope that you would have some sort of lasting impact in office. And you know, there are people that I saw sort of in the office I was working in at the time who saw their mortgages skyrocket, and they haven't come down since. So I suppose, you know, in terms of sort of lasting benefits, she certainly had, or lasting impact, she certainly had some, but not necessarily one that anybody actually wants in a prime minister. And I suppose this is sort of the odd thing about how British politics has been set up for a while now, is that it allowed somebody like Liz Truss to come in. Because, you know, bear in mind, this is somebody who has, you know, who has parked her car in a couple of other ideological cul-de-sacs mm-hmm. before. It was a Lib Dem in college, let's not remember, and an ardent Republican. And of course, well, there's sort of the fact that she met the Queen very early on, and then managed to sort of be the Prime Minister during the Queen's funeral is pretty remarkable. And I suppose it's good. The amount of people that seem to think that she might be the deep state agent is pretty compelling, I suppose, in that regard.
Yeah, look, it's kind of fascinating, maybe for all the wrong reasons. I did find myself wondering, like, what does she want out of it? Because we're going to talk about some of the other politicians who it's a bit more clear what their motivations are this time. Is it appealing for that after politics income to the American audience, and by having the likes of Bannon on, making herself a figure in their magazine where quite a few of them are making quite a bit of money? Or maybe is there something more? Is there a political comeback? Like, wouldn't be a shock to see her join Reform, would it? Or maybe it would, I don't know.
I mean, all bets are off in British politics at the moment. I mean, it is very hard to predict anything. It's kind of in a caged animal sort of way, really, rather than anything more edifying. I mean, I think it comes down to money and ego, really. I mean, I think they have been Liz Truss's sort of guiding lights. I mean, I've worked with a few people that knew her in college, and they didn't have a huge amount of great things to say about her as a Lib Dem than they do as a Tory, let's put it like that. So I think it all comes down to, fundamentally, I think it comes down to money and ego. And you know, this is 2025, and so she's trying to put herself in a, you know, in an American YouTube space. Because, you know, I mean, bear in mind, it's like, this is sort of the situation we're in now, Sean. Directors of the FBI and head people in intelligence in America are coming straight from the podcast sphere. So it's not like what it used to be. You know, it's like, maybe you spend a couple of years at Brookings, maybe you spend a bit of time like in the government, you know, and then you kind of, after many years, sort of rise through the ranks. Now you can come straight from a 4-hour long daily podcast talking about the deep state, and then all of a sudden you're in charge of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of remarkable to think about. The production values on it as well are just fascinating. It's like that, what was that movie in the 2000s? Team America, was it? Or
the sit at the South Park for the guys from South Park.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was just, you know, this kind of heavy rock, and it's like, Liz Truss, you know, it's just absolutely bonkers. He-Man meets Liz Truss is what I'd describe it as. To flip then to the entire other end of the political spectrum, and the new UK Green Party leader, Zach Polanski, because he's kind of faced a different sort of a criticism. Let's hear a little bit of his podcast.
I want to stick with Europe. I've been very heavily criticised in the press recently, the right-wing press, because I said that if I was Prime Minister, would negotiate with Putin. I can't even begin to say how absurd it seems to me that you wouldn't negotiate with anyone, because that sounds to me like you're just ready to go to war with them if you're not even willing to have negotiation on the table.
That's called Bold Politics. It's Zach Polanski's podcast. I suppose he's been criticised on the other side of this kind of cozy left echo chamber of a podcast, I guess.
Yeah, this is always sort of the criticism of I suppose left wing of the left in general and of left wing people in particular is that, you know, they like to talk to people that they agree with and you know, yeah, keep that sort of cozy and to not necessarily, you know, sort of subject yourself to criticism. But I suppose Zach Polanski is coming from a very different angle than Liz Truss is, because Zach Polanski is trying to, you know, make something of a change in British government. And so I suppose if you have a think about the way that sort of people's habits are now, very few people, I think now, relative to sort of maybe what it used to be back in the Breakfast with Frost days or Andrew Marr or whatever, I don't think a huge amount of people are scuttling out of their bed on a Sunday morning, you know, at 8:55 to make sure they're on in time for Laura Koonsberg. Chances are they are more likely now really to be scrolling on Instagram sort of around that time. And it's probably more likely that you're going to see Zach Polanski talking to, whether it's, you know, Sean Fay or Lewis Goodall or Jordan from Rizzlekicks is sort of among some of the people that he's had on recently, and maybe getting a few hits from that and going, oh, that's interesting, sort of, you know, and so it's a way, I suppose, to sort of circumvent sort of the time-honored traditions of how politicians get their words out. Because, and in fact, it's sort of Laura Koonsberg is an instructive example, because, you know, he'd been given out recently about the fact that he'd been bumped to talk about something else. And so, I know, and if you have a look at something like Question Time, or if you have a look at sort of just generally, I suppose, the way that, I suppose, the criticism that Green Party members have is that, you know, they barely get 4 minutes on and they're interrupted most of the time, whereas Reform, you know, who have precisely one MP more than them, you know, end up sort of getting these, you know, big, fascinated, long form interviews with, you know, with Promethean curiosity. So I suppose for Zach Polanski, it's quite a different thing in terms of it's probably quite useful as a political tool to set out his stall, I suppose. Now, whether it requires a politician to have a 45-minute podcast every week is something else entirely. It's serving a different purpose for him. It also serves that there is a way now to undercut mainstream sort of political shows in a way that it would have been very difficult to do about 25 years ago, where you kind of needed to get on the Breakfast News or Newsnight or Breakfast with Frost or Andrew Marr or whatever to get your point across. And that's not really necessary these days.
Yeah, I suppose the question then comes in about what kind of an interview you're getting versus sort of propaganda. And he was on at Rest Is Politics podcast and really kind of had his economic knowledge grilled and didn't really stand up to it.
And this is always going to be the interesting thing, isn't it, about how conversations are framed. And I suppose this is sort of one of the benefits. Like, I mean, if you're a left wing politician, then you're going to want to, as Zach Polanski has talked about, you're going to want to talk about the issues that you want to talk about. You're going to want to talk about, you know, trans rights or rejoining the EU or, you know, toxic masculinity or things like this. Whereas, because, you know, what often happens is, and what we've seen is that in more conventional things like, well, Natalie Bennett comes to mind, just sort of the former Green Party member who had what they called a brain fade on LBC when Nick Ferrari started asking her, you know, sort of a series of fairly sort of technical economic questions. So, yeah, I mean, this is the danger, I suppose, of not subjecting yourself, I suppose, to the kind of like to the broad mainstream amphitheater. But I mean, I suppose the flip side of that is that they get to talk about stuff on their own terms and about things that don't necessarily sort of come up sort of in the newspapers. And if you can widen the conversation to the issues that you care about, in the same way that the likes of Farage has managed to move, you know, what they call the Overton window, sort of the things that it's acceptable to talk about from the other side, then maybe that's a necessary thing to do.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting one. And I mean, one we saw in our own presidential election recently where there was a bit of criticism, like the topic, I suppose, Catherine Connolly, last time we were speaking, was about this presidential election and the voting rights for it. And she brought this, I think, really into the Irish space for the first time and did a lot of the podcasts that wouldn't be considered, I suppose, mainstream media. Here's some of what of her on the How to Gael podcast.
Yeah. I'd say go to the Harvard Akadul though, August. No talk to. I'd say go to anyone to talk to Casul and Ara Dirin. You love the Al Books and the, do you know what, Leve Eg Fowlum.
It's Matlam Veg Fowlum.
Yeah, I'd say so. Well, ain't Tanga in a guts, Catherine.
Gotchura cool tog yaramanish.
Gotchura cool, just permission.
Well, Vishogim Sakim.
Okay.
Akmadulish and Gwil Genura, Hui Merash, Visha Intok Verash, Yeah.
And you can see entirely why, particularly with something like the presidential election that's more ceremonial, someone would go for podcasts like that, or maybe, you know, Louise McSharry was another one she was on, rather than sit in front of Pat Kenny or Sarah McInerney or someone who is just going to give you hell for 25 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does sort of underpin as well as kind of the what the conversations that are worth having are. And I think that maybe this is where the likes of sort of, you know, the Newsnights and the Koonsbergs of the world sort of maybe need to sort of stand up and take notice, because, you know, obviously it's important that your leaders are economically literate and what have you. But, you know, if it's 15 minutes of the same, you know, how are you going to pay for this kind of thing, then I think sort of people tend to sort of switch off from that. However, what I found with the Catherine Connolly thing was is that just how much that had really sort of permeated, I think, people's consciousness, not just in Ireland, but sort of over here, over across the water. Like I was in football group chats where people were talking about Catherine Connolly because of the TikTok that went viral, sort of with her doing the keepy uppies. You know, I think the How to Gael I thought was particularly instructive, because there was at one point one of the presenters says, "Ah, Catherine, you're a gas woman," and I thought that straight away is like, that is absolute gold dust. And especially, like you say, Sean, in a presidential election, where I suppose, you know, there's a personality dimension to it, and there's more it's kind of more the soul of the nation sort of thing. So, you know, being a gas woman, I think, is a very important part of being president. It's about sort of opening up the dimensions, really, of what a political interview can and should be. And, you know, I think it was very clever of her to go to sort of those sort of clippable things. Because, you know, like I say, there are people that I know over here that got those clips on their algorithm. And so it's a fascinating thing to see how that managed to play out. And I suppose, you know, we talk about, you know, sort of in political terms, you know, like when we think of phrases like silent majority, you know, we kind of probably go back to the late 60s and Nixon and sort of in people that weren't creating a lot of noise and, you know, sort of against, you know, sort of hippie movements and whatnot. I think nowadays a silent majority is, you know, is more sort of it's young people that are silent because they've got their headphones in and they're silently scrolling and they're seeing things come along going, ah, that's interesting. Yeah, and people can find that interest wherever they can, sort of such is the nature of the media, and they can get that as much from How to Gael and from Blind Boy as they can from, you know, the Paxmans of this world.
Yeah, it's an interesting one as someone who kind of straddles both broadcast media and the podcast world myself, and the, you know, political world in my day job. Like, if you were in a broadcast interview to say, "God, Catherine, you're gas," at the end of it, you would have Fine Gael complaining to Cumhachin na mBan straight away. You have shown a bias. There would be instant complaints. Whereas in a podcast, it's fine. And that sets up a really weird demarcation point between, if I said that on a podcast for News Talk, it might be fine. If I said it on air, you're suddenly being called into a manager's office.
And this is the interesting thing, isn't it? But I think what's interesting as well, though, from a viewer point of view, is that I think people do appreciate the difference. I mean, I think sort of media literacy in a lot of ways has never been better. And so I think people also sort of get that, you know, I think people are putting that into their calculus, is that, like, you know what, if you're hearing a clip from Blind Boy and Catherine Connolly, then chances, you know that that's going to be a somewhat of a sympathetic conversation. You know, in the same way that, you know, John Stewart would have with Barack Obama back in the day. And he would have, you know, there was quite a bit of criticism as well, that maybe he didn't fire off the questions in the same way that a Dan Rather might have. But the whole point is that John Stewart's there to do a different job. Mm. The fact that he's, you know, politically adjacent, and also maybe the fact that he is, you know, meeting the political moment better than some conventional news anchors, that's a whole other story. And that's a fairly fascinating dimension of things as well, is that where I think in an awful lot of cases, it's the humorists and it's the commentators and it's the satirists that I think are maybe summing up the political situation better than the classic newsmen.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, isn't it? Because there's been maybe a shift, I think, in Irish politics. And maybe the moment of it was in this presidential election and the whole Ivan Yates smear the bejesus thing, which obviously I have a hand in, have to put my hand up on that. That was me asking him that question. But, you know, it used to be, say, Ivan, Eamon Dunphy, George Hook, Fiona Sheehan, sort of grumpy old men doing these interviews during the presidential election. And now it is the How to Gael women or Louise M'Shari or whoever else it is on a much more sympathetic level, but also just it's a tonal shift that we maybe haven't really seen and is only starting to have its shape on Irish politics.
It is, yeah. And I mean, by the way, fair play for the question heard around the world, Sean. I mean, that is that was some crack. And yeah, you know, what I think it is that, like, I've always been of the opinion, you know, that politics with a capital P shouldn't have a high cordon around it. You know, like, people should have a say and a hand in, you know, in the issues that affect them. And that conversation should happen on their own terms. And, you know, I think sometimes what the tendency to happen, and like yourself, Sean, having been on both sides of this, is that sometimes there are some people who sort of work within kind of the corridors of power and of politics, if you like, that I think quite enjoy the soap opera-ness of it all and quite enjoy sort of the, you know, the linguistic jargon of it, and which is fine, and, you know, and there's a nobility in that, but it also means that potentially people are cut out of that conversation, whereas things like How to Gael and Louise M'Shari and you know, and Blind Boy and all sorts of people like it, and, you know, and sort of comedians just sort of interviewing politicians, I think it does potentially open things up in a way that I think is ultimately quite healthy for the ecosystem. Now, you know, I suppose 50 minutes untrammeled, you know, if everything was like that, then I think that's not great. But I think in terms of sort of how we do it, I think we're in much less danger than, say, for example, you know, the President of the United States only taking questions from Newsmax or whoever is his flavor of the month that week, you know. So, like, these problems are existing within the capital P high cordon kind of politics as well. So I don't think that there's necessarily an existential threat, if you like, to the idea that, you know, because I think politicians should be subject to people in all manner of ways. And and they should be more prepared for questions beyond that. And how are you going to pay for that minister? Because I think this is the reason why so much of this lands so well, or when it lands well, it lands really well. And indeed, in the case of Liz Truss, that it doesn't land when it doesn't, is authenticity. Authenticity, I think it's like you want to see a sense that a political candidate exists in three dimensions. I don't think you can really run for office now and not be seen to have that. Anybody that makes a success of being authentic, you know, there are so many ways in which you can do that now. But as we've seen with Liz Truss, you kind of, there is sort of an uncanny trying to it. And, you know, so when it fails, it really does fail.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Let's have a listen. And while you're talking about that sort of full-term view and authenticity and everything, some politicians have tried it here, albeit to mixed results. Simon Harris, for example, sort of perpetually online. Here he is talking to Ryan Tuberty about his family.
My parents are extraordinary. Like, they've just been really, really supportive of all of us. And, you know, no matter what I wanted to be in life, or my sister, or my brother, they would have done anything and moved mountains to help us and to support us. And, you know, my parents, as I say, weren't political, certainly weren't party political. We're involved in things in the community, sports clubs and parents' associations and the likes over the years. But, like, the amount of leaflets my father and mother have dropped for me over the years, you know, the amount of cups of coffee they've made for canvassers, wow, the amount of things they've done to help. And that's, I suppose, the love of a parent. But yeah, I'm very grateful for it.
Simon Harris talking to Ryan Tuberty there. We've also seen in the past the Taoiseach having his own podcast in conversation, which was a little bit short-lived, but took a bit of a different tone, him asking the questions for a change.
And I think one of the great lessons from that, in some respects, as a former Minister for Health, is that the national debate always focuses on the emergency, on the immediate, often to the detriment of the more longer-term thinking. I mean, prevention ultimately should always be the key health policy.
So what do you make of the Irish politicians' foray into this? I think this week Simon Harris started a Substack, which is a sentence I didn't think I would ever say, but there you go. Although he doesn't seem to have got it, I think it is just basically his press releases put onto Substack. So have they got the hang of it, or is it still sort of, we have this legacy way that we presented ourselves and now we're putting it onto new platforms?
I think this is a really tricky one. I mean, I think the veil between politics and showbiz, I don't think has ever been thinner, has ever been more translucent. And so I can understand why people would feel the need to sort of to get involved in that. You know, it's like, I mean, I suppose I don't think there's a person in the country now at this point is like, should we start a podcast? Should we be on that? And I think that's probably in terms of sort of Leinster House as well. I can understand why people do it. Again, it comes back to authenticity, but it also comes back to, in essence, knowing when to hold them and when to fold them, you know? I mean, it's like not everybody should be doing everything. Like the last thing we need, right, is for TDs to think, oh, well, it works so well for Catherine Connolly going on Blind Boy. What we need to do now is that we need to get Piers Doherty and Owen O'Brien to do their best Vittorio Angeloni and Mike Rice impression. We don't need that, you know? We don't need that. And it's like, you know what? Maybe they could go on that podcast and maybe it would be a tremendous viral success, like as one hit. But I think people need to be quite careful about, you know, even though we're sort of media saturated at the moment and it sort of it might feed a drop in the ocean, it also, you don't want to contribute to the ennui of it as well. And at the end of the day, I think people want their politicians to communicate what they're doing or what they intend to do. They don't necessarily want them to be media personalities in their own right. And I think this is one of the big problems that we've had in British politics for a long time is that, you know, famously Boris Johnson became prime minister in no small part due to his profile from Have I Got News For You. But you do sometimes get the impression is that some MPs and ministers have it the wrong way around. You see them on, you know, at the dispatch box with the sincere hope that Have I Got News For You will happen to them then or after their career. So I don't necessarily think that we need that. And I think, again, it comes into that idea of authenticity, and it's about sort of like reading the room, really. So we don't necessarily need Micheál Martin, you know, to be kind of doing a podcast with Bruce Springsteen or whatever, you know. It's like we just need sort of good communication from him. And when you think about sort of some of the best people to do that in America, and most of the best communicators on this are in America, I think, then that's what they're doing. They're communicating what it is that they want to do in a very genuine way, and that's why they're so popular.
Yeah. Gavin Newsom, I suppose, being one of those, who listened to a bit of his, it actually wasn't bad. Of all the ones that I listened to on my way in, the different political interviews, you've got me thinking about who in Leinster House should start a podcast. If we could get like Michael Lowry together with Paul Murphy or something, do a real double act, you know. But maybe people can let us know, newstalkdaily@newstalk.com, what TDs would you actually like to hear on a podcast, and who do we hear plenty enough of as it is. Paddy Duffy, thanks so much for joining us again on Newstalk Daily.
Thank you, Sean.
That's it for this episode. My thanks to producer Tom Donnelly and researcher Micheál O'Connell. From me, Sean Defoe, goodbye and chat to you in the next episode.